What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. We've got a great show coming up, but before we start, remember, for all the news that you need to know, go to thenation.com. Nobody owns The Nation, and that's why The Nation isn't owned. Also, you got to check out this podcast I'm listening to by Jeff Zinn, called Gurus, The Story of Acting from Stanislavski to Secession. It's available for listening wherever you get your podcasts. But enough of my yapping. Let's start the show.
Hoops legend Shamiqua Holdsclaw, Abdullah Al-Aryan, who wrote the book about soccer in the Middle East. I got things to say about the U.S. women's national team and their loss and why people on the right are celebrating it, but you got to stay tuned. Edge of Sports, it's on now.
A champion is bred from hard times, scarred mind, standing on the ledge. The squad grind all time, victory in spite of opposition. Welcome to competition. You pick a side, I pick a side, they pick a side. Take a knee against abuse, they'd rather you die. Pushing through dark tunnels, trying to shed light. The fight is on the moment we enter the game of life. Get it right before the whole thing gone dead. Let's go ahead and take it there. Meet me on the edge.
Welcome to Edge of Sports, the TV show only on the Real News Network. I'm Dave Zirin, and this week we've got another legend for you, one of the great hoopsters of all time. You may remember her from the NCAA championships at the University of Tennessee and from racking up enough individual honors to fill a closet. You may remember her iconic cover on Slam Magazine in a Knicks uniform. You may remember her from the WNBA, and you may know about her heroic mental health advocacy. I'm talking about the great Shamiqua Holdsclaw. Also, I've got some choice words about the gleeful response by the so-called patriots on the political right to the defeat of the U.S. women's national soccer team. We're calling it reactionary defeatism. And lastly, in our recurring segment, Ask a Sports Scholar, I've got the great professor Abdullah Al-Aryan, whose book, Football in the Middle East, State, Society, and the Beautiful Game, is a must-read for all sports fans. But first, let's talk to the one and only Shamiqua Holdsclaw. Shamiqua Holdsclaw, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
This is just something I've always wanted to ask you. You've done so much on and off the court. What fills you with the most pride when you sit back and look back at your journey?
Wow, what fills me with the most pride? I would just say the fact that, you know, I've been able to overcome, find balance, find happiness, contribute to others' happiness in a positive way, and bring people together, you know, bring people together with love, with great energy, because I've really realized that there was a divide a lot of times because people don't necessarily interact in other people's neighborhoods or things. They think it's so different, you know, everybody's so different. Oh my God, New Yorkers are this way. Tennesseans are this way. But honestly, when you uncover it all, we're all going through the same things. We're all more connected than we will ever know. So I've just enjoyed being able to sort of like bridge that gap in my own way.
Wow. You know, you came forward about mental health challenges, when really no one in the sports world was taking that step. It was still seen as something that one just did not discuss. You wrote about it. You were the subject and creator of a superb documentary called Mind Game, The Unquiet Journey of Shamiqua Holdsclaw. And I just had to ask you, was there a fear factor involved for you as a public figure in coming forward?
Was there a fear factor? Of course, you know, yes, being a public figure, but you got to think about it too, you know, just culturally. You know, I was always told like things that happen in my household, you know, stays in my household, you know, we're of people that overcome, you know, through our faith in the church. So, you know, you put your head down and you push through it, but that pushing through really wasn't helping me. Then on the flip side, you have being a high level athlete, you know, since I was younger, it's surround yourself with the right people, stay on course, do the right thing. And when that kind of started to unravel a little bit, there was a fear of being judged, a fear of, you know, not being looked at as this, you know, strong woman who's overcome, you know, from her life in New York to go to Tennessee to be a champion. To have to reveal there's like kinks in the armor is very fearful.
Yeah. But then subsequently, after you came forward, there were players like Kevin Love and DeMar DeRozan, the great tennis star, Naomi Osaka. I mean, I could go on and on of top athletes who stepped forward to say, this is not a weakness, mm-hmm. and we need to break the stigmas. Was that gratifying for you? Or like, what was the emotional response for you when you were like, oh, wow, actually started something?
Babe, I was like, finally, it's amazing. Because the thing about it, you know, whether it's a high level performing individuals, whether it's business, sports, entertainment, you have to learn that you have to protect yourself, and you have to learn the power of your voice and not be afraid because of corporations and business to take care of you. So from Osaka to Love to DeRozan, you know, all the athletes just so brave. I was just really excited about the cultural shift, because with social media helps a lot, because a lot of these young kids, they'll know, you know, they may not know anything about basketball, but they'll know who a Selena Gomez is. Because I guess at one time she was like the most followed person on Instagram. So when you have, you know, eight-year-old kids or whatever, like, yeah, Selena Gomez had to go get help because she was depressed, because, and I'm like, wow, like times are changing. And so now people see other people speaking out. They can connect to those people, or in some cases, you know, they relate to them, and that empowers them to want to be better and to get the help that they need.
Mm. You know, you're inspiring me to ask this question in this particular way. I had a rough morning, mm-hmm. Between my ears, and I'm usually pretty steady. This morning, not the case for a host of reasons I won't share with you. Mm-hmm. What's your process when you feel challenged?
Oh my God. And again, you know, shout out to all the parents out there, because it's, you know, it's not like an easy job. And until you kind of like gone through it yourself, you realize that. So for me, every morning when I wake up, it's like, how can I be the best for my wife and for my kids? Because I'm human, you know, I have emotions, like you said, or, you know, you may get some news and it kind of knocks you off. My process is, you know, I pray. Mm. I have to have quiet time. When something hits me, I'll just tell my wife, hey, I'm going for a walk. I like to listen to nature sounds, you know, like I'm big into the sound machine. And if it's something that I really need to get off my chest, you know, because a part of me, I was like, I have this introverted side. And I know when I was really, really hammered down by my challenges, I wasn't able to talk to my friends about it or my family. I just kind of like stuffed my feelings and emotions. Over the years, talking about this topic and educating my friends, they're just a great support, my family and friends. So sometimes, you know, I may walk and I need to call a friend and I need to like decompress. And to know that I have that, you know, I have somebody that's going to listen to me and support me and not necessarily tell me what I should do, just really listening, you know, because at the end of the day, I think a lot of people know which direction they want to go. They just need to get stuff off their chest. And so I'm grateful just to have different tools that have allowed me to be in a better place as far as my mental health.
Wow. Thank you for that. You know, I was talking with our mutual friend, Etan Thomas, I'll never forget, years ago, mm-hmm. about you. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, wow, Shamiqua Holdsclaw doing this as a top level pro athlete coming forward, that takes courage. And Etan looked at me for a long moment and he says, it also takes courage to come at this from the Black community and speaking about mental health. And I'm obviously in no place to ask this question, but through Etan, I shall ask this question is, does that present a challenge that we collectively need to be aware of?
Oh, definitely. Especially like where I'm from, you know, this is, I can only speak to my journey, you know, growing up, I'm going to live with my grandmother at 11 and living in the housing projects here in Astoria, you know, it's like, you don't have those conversations. Like I said, you just got to put your head down and push through things. And you got people really, or some people living paycheck to paycheck, you know, issues at their jobs, just really trying to be better parents, trying to be better people. And they feel like society is like coming at them from so many different angles. And they don't have time to like breathe, you know, to say, oh, I need to go to therapy. They afford therapy? It's so expensive, right? And so you have like a lot of this stuff, you just put your head and you deal with it, or you go to church and you try to pray it away. So many people told me that the stuff that I've encountered, you know, in the church, you know, people, oh, that's that girl, that bipolar girl. And yes, Dave, I've heard this about myself from, you know, someone in the church, because when I went through my second episode, I really felt like I had to work this process myself. I felt like I had friends and support in my corner, but I had to go through this healing. And it was really like my faith that helped me through. A lot of people don't know, and I probably haven't shared this too much. I don't think I probably even shared this, but I was in church. Like, I would go to church on the weekends, but it was like Saturday service. I was there Saturday, Sunday, and I was there for the service during the week, because I felt like that was the only way for me to get through. But it's disheartening when you hear, you know, people in the church, like kind of putting you down, like this is a place for healing, right? Mm-hmm. In community. So without going too far off, we just have to have those spaces. You know, it was always counseling in churches for finances, right? Marriage counseling. And so now, you know, the last 15 years, most places of worship have a place where people can get counseling to be better, because a lot of people suffer from seasonal, you'll say seasonal depression or something. I know on the West Coast, Portland, Seattle, it's a big thing, but I know, you know, it gets gray out, you know, snowing, everybody's spirit gets a little down. It's when that doesn't go away, you know, when that doesn't go away and it's affecting your work, it's affecting your family life or whatever, you have to take that step to say, hey, I need help. But is this great to see for people of color that that place now is in a church, you know, and not to get discouraged, because I never forget that day. I don't want to say what church I was at, but I just felt like, boom, and I ran away. And I called my mother. I was like, I'm never going there again. You know, this lady said that. And she's like, you know what? You can't let other people affect your peace. My mother said this. And I was like, what are you saying? She goes, no, you go back and you continue to stay steadfast and continue to encourage others, because this is, you know, this is your God doing work in your life. And she was right. And I went back and I shared his story. And I'm like, listen, we got to come together in places where there's a lot of us, help people through their challenges and difficulties. One thing that I would say, like, really opened my eyes was, I met a man and, you know, good job, whatever. And it's a black gentleman. And he was just like telling me about his challenges. He could identify with some things I was going through, and he had been in the military and stuff. And he goes, man, just, I can't even, I'm afraid. I'm afraid to ask for help. He's like, my job offers therapy, but I'm afraid if they found out, my employer, that I'm using the services, that they'll just judge me. So I'm looking at this guy and I'm like, so all of this stuff that you told me, the different trauma you experienced, you're afraid to be better because of what other people are going to say and do. And I looked at him and I was like, man, you got to knock down that door. You got to take that step. And he's just like, I got to provide for my daughter and stuff. Man, I was like, you got to forget that. You got to be the best you, because right now you're not bringing that to your daughter. You're not bringing that to your wife. The world is already a heavy place for a man of color anyway. And fast forward, this is probably, I think it's like 10 years ago, me and this gentleman had this conversation. And through social media and stuff, we stayed in contact. And the therapy has changed his life.
Wow.
You know,
that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. You know, right now, as we have this conversation, we're dealing with what's been described as a youth mental health crisis, particularly in the wake of the pandemic, although I think it precedes that. You know, when you were young, you're a New York City high school phenom, Christ the King, four yes. straight New York State championships.
Right.
Amazing. Something we still talk about in NYC.
Right.
Had mental health challenges surfaced for you during that time of such glory? And what advice do you have for the youth dealing with this?
Wow. I started experiencing challenges when I was like 11 or 12 years old. And okay. my grandmother did try to attempt to get me some help and understanding, but you know, you hear those things, right? Like, oh, what happens in your house stays in your household. Then you're taking me to the community center where I met by a white gentleman who I feel like I'm looking around. There's not many white people in this community. And now they want me to like open up and share and talk to him. And at a young age, I didn't feel like safe in that right. space. And, you know, I learned to just sports at that time was really becoming a big thing in my life. And so I learned to just put my energy into that, you know, to work hard. Because if you start to see like all these amazing male players at the time in New York City, you see the Bobby Knights, you see Coach K's coming to New York, and you get to like witness that. I'm like, oh, my God. One day I want that to happen. So I felt like sports could change my life, as it did. But high school, I was going through a lot. My mom, you know, she was in and out of rehab for drinking and, you know, showing up intoxicated at my games. And I was really embarrassed, but like, just, it was like traumatic for me emotionally. All that time, no one ever asked me, hey, you know, do you want to talk about this? None of my coaches, because it was like I was a talent, and it was like when I kicked the garbage can and I'm upset, it was just like everyone stroking the shoulder. I call it the coach mentality. Whenever you're good at something and people see that, you know, whether it's music, art, whatever, they kind of want to put you on this path and massage you, you know. Mm-hmm. And you can't, that's something that you gotta get out of it. So I love now how, yes, New York is still, in my opinion, the mecca of basketball, but all these summer activities and things these shoe companies are putting on here in New York is great, that a lot of them are adding the wellness component, you know? A lot of coaches now are doing like mental health first aid, you know? So they can understand how to address these young people. So I love it. And I love how things are, you know, just moving forward.
You know, describing your high school years, it just is making me feel how heroic it was for you to say, I'm going to Knoxville for all the culture shock issues that would inevitably come up going to small town Tennessee. But then freshman year, you're dominating. So how difficult, but also we can't look at athletics as the indicator for how somebody's doing either. So how difficult was the transition? And you know, you're being coached by one of the greatest ever in Pat Summitt. Right. But who's also, of course, very demanding, very old school, very serious. How did that translate for you, given what was going on internally?
I felt like Coach Summitt, like amazing coach, right? Like amazing, successful, but even better person. And I was really thankful for the mentorship and the friendship, you know, like she was an extension of my grandmother, helped me navigate things when I came forward with her regarding my mental health. But again, you're young, right? You're young. None of my parents or whatever, they went to college, like 2-year schools. They didn't know what it was like going. No one prepared me for going to a big university. Even though I had like a lot of, you know, I went to Christ the King. So you had a lot of kids that went on to college or whatever, but I don't know. I don't think I was really knew what I was getting into, and to go there And it was a culture shock. I was used to so much diversity. You know, I had friends, all different religions, all different backgrounds, and, you know, the train accessibility. And here it was like, plop, you're on this campus and you really are trying to navigate to find your tribe. And, you know, I'm like, oh man, these people talk too slow. They're telling me I talk too fast. But Coach Summit understood. She'd been coaching at that time for 20 something years. She understood how to bring together sisterhood and community. And she just told me, my grandmother, to be patient, because I wanted to transfer. You're young, you're like, I'm out of here. This doesn't feel comfortable, right? And I'm glad that she taught me a good lesson. Like, you know, you got to work the process, you know, don't quit, like work the process. And I think a lot of how she dealt with me has really helped me in my life through challenges, because yes, life is hard. You're going to sometimes be on uncommon ground, but you have different skill sets, Shamequa. She's always like, you're great with people. People are gonna love you. You're great at bringing community together. And so those are your strengths. You know, she wanted me to understand who I was, because I was shy. I was so shy. I was just like, kind of like head down, pressing along. But it was all these big feelings and emotions inside. And when she allowed me to be me, she would ask me how I'm feeling. I can talk. I felt safe. It really like started to change for me, and understanding like I was a leader, understanding like this is different, but I can talk about it. I can talk about the things that make me feel awkward here. You know, like, I didn't like country music. I said that one time. I didn't, you know, now I'm older, right? I was like 18 years old, and they asked me, like, they were like, do you like country music on a station? And I was like, no, I don't like country music. Do you know, like, I was like attacked. These people are writing in and saying, I dare her say that. But again, I was not exposed to that, right?
Sure. So,
you know, being able to like just grow and find your place. And, you know, it was an education for me to understand a Southern way of things, and for other people to understand like how I grew up, you know?
Do you go back to Knoxville sometimes?
Yes, I go back to.
What's that like for you?
Look, Dave, it's not just Knoxville. It's Knox Vegas.
Knox Vegas. Yes.
It's great just to see like how much things have grown. And it's about the young people, you know. We have a program, right? And it's just, they know like who the pioneers were. They know a lot of these young ladies, they don't know who Pat Summit is, right? Like some of the younger kids, you know, but it's just like great, you know, the kids that come there doing their homework, just being respectful, seeing how the facilities have grown. Like this college now it was big business. We thought before is big business now. And so, you know, just seeing the young ladies, you know, have that opportunity to compete as collegiate athletes, to be rewarded in a way they never been rewarded before with the NIL stuff, to go back and to see how my stadium, Thompson Bowling Arena, is like so amazing. I mean, they have suites now. You get suites. It's like amazing. But I have a lot of pride, because those people, like through challenges, through life, they've always like had my back, like just really awesome people. My college teammate, Kelly Jelly, my point guard, is actually the head coach there now. So that's awesome. I would say Tennessee, we tend to keep it in the family, you know?
Mm-hmm. Before you go, I got to ask you just a couple of hoops questions.
All right, cool.
Because women's hoops is exploding like never before, particularly at the NCAA level. You laid the basis for everything we're seeing in 2023. What player or team gets you hype?
Oh my God. Oh, you want to start with collegiate first?
Wherever you want to start.
Man, okay. Like I just love the confidence of the young ladies from LSU. Like I love it, you know, because for so long, you know, I don't know if you notice, like men after a game, a lot of times they'll just, you know, peace and keep walking. But it was always like an expectation for the women to like shake hands and, you know, be the good girls, and we can't show our toughness or we're acting like a boy or whatever. But like to see these young ladies claim their space, you know, like, yes, I'm gonna talk trash too, because I'm telling you, growing up, man, I had to like talk so much, and then you're like, the camera's on you and it's like, handle yourself a certain way. I love them being able to authentically express like who they are. to share their journey. Like Angel Reese said, I'm from Baltimore. And again, she said it with the Baltimore accent. I'm not quite getting it, but saying we talk trash everywhere. Now, I've been to Baltimore. I'm sure you have too. And it's just like, oh
we're recording from Baltimore.
Okay. 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 Awesome. So I'm like, oh, I get it. I can identify with this young lady's journey. And then just seeing how it's grown. I mean, just most viewership ever. So I would say Angel Reese. I like the young lady, Caitlin. I'll be excited to see what she does on the next level professional wise. Oh man, it's just so many amazing players, you know. My wife's favorite player is Della Don. And so I got a funny story. So we actually watched the DC games or whatever. And my son, it was last year. So he's about 2 years old at the time. So he's watching. So I go to meet the team and he's with me. And, you know, we do the circle, introduce yourself to everybody. He runs up to Della Don and he's just like, and she picks him up because he remembered who she was.
That is sweet.
Yeah, so Della Don, Asia Wilson. Those are kind of like my two favorite players. Awesome.
That's your go-to. And yes. Yeah, how would you do in today's WNBA? And would your style of play be any different?
Oh man. I would crush it. you know, my style, I feel like I was like one of the first like big guards, you know, that can put the ball on the floor, athleticism, could handle the basketball. So I think my game would like translate really well. Because I understood like, you know, how to get to the basket and pass, but it would just be different now because the fun part of being different is that, man, I would probably be going up against more women my size at the position. For me, I was always one of the bigger ones playing the three slot. So I had like a really good post-up game. I could take advantage of that. But I realized the game changed probably 2010. That was my last season. And I was San Antonio and I'm facing Candace Parker, my fellow Tennessee alumni. And she caught the ball and I'm like behind her. And next thing you know, before I could like blink, she had gone around me and scored. And I was like, whoa, the game has changed, the athleticism, you know?
No volunteer love on that play. No. I think you'd be like Breonna Stewart with a jetpack. That's how I picture you in today's game.
She's an amazing player. I ran into her. I went to the Brooklyn Library the other day with my other friend from UConn to see the Jay-Z exhibition. And I come
outside. Everybody's talking about it.
It was amazing. I come outside and she's there, so we were all chopping it up.
That's amazing. What a window into a day in the life in Brooklyn. Just Breonna Stewart and Shamika Oldschool chopping it up at the Jay-Z exhibit. Yo, how can people keep up with you? And thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I'm keeping up with me. Whoa, my God. I keep a low social profile, but I would say Instagram, I'm trying to get better to post about my, you know, when I'm out speaking or, you know, with my family to share, you know, what I'm doing. So my Instagram is CHOLD1. Mm-hmm. And if you need me otherwise, you can find Tandem Sports and the Washington, D.C. area. And I work with them, you know, Lon Babby, and then Jim Tanner took over. So I've been with them since 99. So it's like family. So you can always contact them if you need me.
Shamika Holdsclaw, thank you so much for joining us here on Edge of Sports. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. You take care of yourself. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
And now some choice words. Okay, look, in left politics, there is a philosophy called revolutionary defeatism. It means calling for your own country to lose when engaging in an imperialist war. Such a call, never popular, is essential towards the task of building internationalism and fighting the thirst for conquest. It's a noble call whose root lies in the desire to end human suffering. Well, in the U.S. of A. right now, we are seeing something that I think is best described as reactionary defeatism. This is the call for the United States to lose in its various rivalries with other countries, but not out of some thirst to end nationalism or war, not at all. Instead, this twisted and bizarrely fantastical view is that the United States has given too many rights to too many people, and we are now, as a result, losers. For them, this country, like Germany in the 1920s before the rise of the Nazis, represents a hedonistic hellscape, and any humiliation on the world stage is not only welcome, it is to be cheered. Reactionary defeatism was on full display when the United States women's national team was bounced from the 2023 World Cup. Their loss was surprising, but not necessarily shocking. While the U.S. was going for its unprecedented third straight World Cup, many other countries have made giant strides in their development of women's soccer, reaching and training players beyond the middle-class pipeline that dominates in the United States. Also, our team was an uneasy mix of experience and youth, and their coach, Vlatko Andonovski, engaged in substitution patterns best described as bewildering. So they lost. Not expected, but it happens. But in the aftermath, what has both surprised and shocked many, although this has been brewing for some time, is the utter glee with which this country's reactionary right wing has responded. They have acted like the ouster of the U.S. women was greater than if the Super Bowl was held on Christmas Day. Many commentators on the mainstream sports channels have actually struggled to explain why a section of this country, led by a vocally joyous Donald Trump, cheered their defeat. Many of the same patriotic souls who wanted Colin Kaepernick and USWNT icon Megan Rapinoe destroyed for kneeling during the anthem in 2016 loved seeing the red, white, and blue go down. Look, there is much to unpack here in this backwards exercise of reactionary defeatism beyond the obvious that politics clearly no longer stop at the water's edge. The anger, we are told by the Fox News commentators and the centrist press, is because the team is polarizing as a result of being too woke, although no one seems able to say just exactly what that means. Beneath the buzzwords, the hatred comes down to two things, both equally stupid. The first is that they can't stand Rapinoe and assume that the team is made up with a bunch of Rapinoe carbon copies, an absurd charge if you know anything about the actual human beings that played on this team. They also can't stand, although they won't say it explicitly, choosing in cowardly fashion to hide behind that word woke, that this team organized and won equal pay. Equal pay they more than deserved by any metric. The U.S. women's national team is the most successful, popular soccer squad this country has ever produced, and at minimum, they deserved parity in their compensation. Their great sin, when you dig in, is that these are women who refuse to be controlled and sit in the corner. Because of that, Donald Trump, an abuser and assaulter of women, finds them intolerable. His followers are along for the ride because it valorizes their misogyny. Yet their joy at seeing the women fail also destroys a central right-wing election talking point. The GOP is openly running against transgender existence by saying that they will, quote, protect women's sports from biological males. But here they are mocking women athletes and cheering their loss. They have revealed themselves. They don't want to protect women's sports. They hate women's sports because if we want to get real, they hate women, or at the very least, women who dare not know their place. The U.S. women's national team, and especially the legendary Rapinoe, do not need the support of parasitical hypocrites who only care about women's sports if it advances their cause to eradicate trans kids. But this is what reactionary defeatism is all about. They want the United States team to lose because they want to divide and demoralize people as part of an effort to radically remake this country. They want the United States to lose because they want everything Megan Rapinoe, female, queer, anti-racist, pro-choice, outspoken, everything that Megan Rapinoe represents, they want it to wither away. But they don't realize Megan has an army, and it's an army that win or lose will not be marching backwards. Professor Abdullah Al-Aryan, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Good to be here.
So, Professor Al-Aryan, usually on the show, we have people who dedicate their whole lives to the study of sports. Your academic history is so much more eclectic than just sports. And yet you focused on editing and writing this volume, Football in the Middle East, State Society and the Beautiful Game. Why did you choose that to be your project?
I mean, for one thing, I think just being a fan of the game, as somebody who's been watching it my entire life, but especially recently seeing the kind of the intersections. I mean, in a lot of ways, following kind of in your footsteps, Dave, with seeing the intersections of sports and politics, seeing the way that it affects, you know, societies in this region in the same way that you've studied it in, you know, in the United States and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I think that there was certainly a pull there for me and for many of the researchers and scholars who kind of contributed to this volume, who've kind of seen the same thing, that this is not just a game or not just a sport, but something that actually has a much deeper impact in society. And so it connects in a lot of ways to the bigger questions that I've been looking at, you know, my whole life, going back to kind of my days as a PhD student, which is thinking about social movements, thinking about change, thinking about challenges to the, you know, the kind of the hegemonic or powerful orders that govern states and societies in this region.
Mm. Over a decade ago, we had what is called the Arab Spring. How much did the Arab Spring affect or shape your thoughts about pursuing this book?
Yeah, I mean, I was actually in the middle of writing my PhD dissertation at the time that the protests broke out. I was conducting a lot of my fieldwork in Egypt at the time, but of course I was watching those events like everybody else, you know, unfolding on the news and on social media, like in real time. And one of the things that we noted at the time was the impact that organized groups that were not necessarily seen as politicized beforehand, right? So we're not just talking about groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, who everybody, of course, expected to kind of step into the breach that was left behind by these, you know, secular dictatorships, but really thinking about other kinds of social collectivities, things like football ultras, right? So the fan groups that usually had kind of a space to gather and to mobilize in support of their favorite team. They would gather in stadiums, they would rally around, kind of like the equivalent of tailgating, I guess, in the US, where they would sort of rally and gather in public spaces ahead of games, after games. And the way that they mobilized in the service of a budding revolution, I think, was something that a lot of people took note of at the time. And it's taken kind of a decade to really think about maybe some of the long-term impact of that, which is the way that even cultural forces can offer avenues by which people can try to impact change within their own societies. And so I think, you know, that among many other kind of factors, you know, helped us look at kind of what are the impact that fan groups or these ultras can have. And I think it's quite the statement when you actually look at what's going on in Egypt now, which of course had a military coup in 2013. So now we're actually a decade on from the end of that short-lived revolution to one of the most repressive systems, mm-hmm. Really anywhere in the region right now. And it's a testament to the role that those football ultras had, that they were permanently disbanded as soon as the coup took power. And in fact, fans were banned from stadiums until 2018. But even to this day, fan groups as a collectivity, as an organized force, are not allowed to attend matches. And so I think that says a lot about the regime's continued fear, even of just, you know, ordinary kind of football fans, in terms of the impact that they could possibly have in challenging the power of this regime.
Well, if someone had said fan groups for anywhere in the world, frankly, before the Arab Spring, you know, you imagine fights, you imagine a lot of inter-scene battles. And some of the ugliest examples, you know, at the former Yugoslavia, you even saw them activated for highly reactionary ends. How much did it surprise, shock, invigorate you to see these clubs actually come into their own politically in Tahrir Square? And then, of course, the regime, as you said, were very aware of their political import to the upheaval.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, there's so many different elements to it. On the one hand, of course, it's the idea that you can translate things that are effectively just an expression of kind of fan support, right? So we've seen them, of course, fighting one another, right? Different fan groups. Unfortunately, it's an ugly side of the game that we've also kind of looked at in terms of how fan groups interact and engage with each other, sometimes through violence or through kind of these mobilized campaigns. But the way that then all of those differences were set aside in the service of something bigger. And you know, a lot of their interactions previously in terms of dealing with police brutality, dealing with the kind of the crackdowns, dealing with even the infiltration of their groups by undercover police operatives, all of that kind of came into play in terms of them being more seasoned, more experienced in confronting a lot of those same things as they were unfolding in those, you know, those critical moments and weeks leading to the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. But even later, so years later, in a place like Algeria, when you had a similar kind of campaign emerge, one of the interesting things is that a lot of the football fan culture was universalized. That so it wasn't any longer about just a few groups. It was actually about taking kind of some of the fan chants and repurposing them against, you know, an aging dictator who was trying to run for his like fifth or sixth presidential term, and trying to get him to step down. This was an aging president who hadn't even been seen in public. In fact, when all of the politicians came to profess their fealty to him, they did it to a portrait of him because the real version was simply incapacitated. And so this is the kind of thing that you know, the fans were protesting against, many of them, of course, being really young and not having known a single other political alternative throughout their entire lives. And so we saw even the TIFO displays. These are those like massive banners that are usually unfurled like in a stadium in the beginning stages of a match. And yet we saw them in the public squares. We saw the same kind of graffiti and street art of the songs that were repurposed, all of them kind of taking things that were very much a part of, you know, football fandom and then translating them into things that would be seen as kind of protest art and protest expressions.
You know, it's impossible to speak about the Middle East monolithically, as you well know. But we're also doing this interview in the immediate aftermath of the Women's World Cup. That's when we're airing right now. And so even though we can't speak about the Middle East as a one thing, where are we with the development of the women's game in the region?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it certainly has a long way to go with in comparison to what we've seen globally. I will say, you know, I think it's been really fun seeing yet again another Moroccan national team kind of exceed all expectations. So I think that was really thrilling, not just obviously for Morocco, but for people across this region who now see specifically, you know, an opportunity for the national team of women, the women's national team kind of make its own you know, impact in an international tournament. And so I think, you know, despite the defeat to France, again, another defeat to France, the same as the men suffered in the semifinal in the last Men's World Cup, that we still see, I think, tremendous momentum. I think there were a lot of incredible stories about different members of the team, you know, seeing profiles of them. Of course, you had that story about the first woman in hijab being allowed to compete, something that wasn't previously allowed. And is still not allowed in most of the European domestic leagues, especially in France. So I think there are a number of kind of important impact statements there. And at the same time, of course, there's still quite a long way to go when we think about, you know, what's been happening in Saudi Arabia, where the men's game has been kind of taken off in part artificially through this kind of massive injection of hundreds of millions of dollars at the same time that they've kind of announced the establishment of a women's national team. But that hasn't really seen the same kind of impact.
Yeah, as we look around the Middle East, my eyes often turn to Palestine. What role does soccer play? And can we look at it differently or judge it differently, whether in Gaza or the West Bank?
Yeah, I mean, it obviously has a really deep and rich history there that goes back decades, really to the era of British colonial rule. The same way it was kind of introduced in much of this region was through the era of colonialism, whether by the British or the French. In the case of Palestine, it was the British who established the earliest leagues. And it's been part and parcel of Palestinian society in the face of kind of all of the you know, various challenges that they faced, from obviously the denial of their own national rights to their being subjugated under both, you know, ethnic cleansing, to the apartheid regime and occupation that are currently reigning over, you know, over all of these territories. And so in that sense, the obstacles that they face have been tremendous, from even fielding a national team, right? Not being able to even have practices of players who are based in Gaza, who are basically in what is effectively an open air prison where they're not allowed to leave, to the West Bank, which of course is completely cut off through the series of checkpoints that make it almost impossible to be able to like organize in any kind of meaningful way. And so we're seeing a national team that really doesn't have any of the kind of the facilities, let alone even the kind of freedom of movement that's necessary to be able to actually compete. And yet at the same time, there's still a team, it still competes. It's often been hosted in foreign stadiums in the event that, some of the players can get clearance to travel. And I think it continues to exist as kind of a symbol of some of the forms of resistance and mobilization against the occupation, as in terms of when you actually see it compete quite often, even in stadiums where they're competing against the home team, that you'll actually see the that most of the home fans are cheering on the Palestinian team because of what that signifies. We saw lots of outpouring of support throughout the World Cup. I mean, they were kind of, unofficially maybe the 33rd team at the last World Cup, in part because it was held in the region. And so you saw the crowds, you know, coming in and waving their Palestinian flags, in part as a means of, demonstrating that kind of solidarity for a team that doesn't really have the same kinds of, opportunities as many of the others.
The World Cup in Qatar was, of course, held up to tremendous criticism in terms of how it was organized, the labor issues, everything. I also feel like those of us, myself included, who looked at it through that lens missed part of the story. What did it mean to have the World Cup in Qatar?
Well, I mean, I think for one thing, certainly a lot of those criticisms were definitely justified and very much part of the story, right? So there's certainly questions about, how do you reconcile what it means for populations in a region that clearly has an immense passion for the game and sees it as an outlet to mobilize, in part, as I mentioned, in opportunities that don't really exist quite often. And at the same time, reconciling that with some of the serious questions that it ultimately raised. And I think, you know, there was an attempt to try to kind of draw that balance in a way by recognizing what this means for people locally in this region, people who are given an opportunity to travel to a World Cup that may never come again, when we consider the fact that the next World Cup is in the US, Canada, Mexico. With the US, we know everything about the immigration policies there and what it means, you know, for fans, let's say, from Iran. Let alone, you know, maybe from some of the other countries in the region that wouldn't be able necessarily to cheer on their own teams. And I think also, seeing the kind of the cross-national solidarities, I mean, I think that was one of the most incredible things, was the way in which people kind of really connected over football by being able to kind of, you know, bandwagoning, I know, is usually seen as a pejorative. In this sense, I think it was actually really quite a scene to see everybody kind of getting behind Morocco, right? So they were kind of the last team from this region that were still in it. And everybody kind of, you know, picking up the Morocco colors and going to their matches. And those were some of the most incredible scenes that I've seen. In addition to, of course, like I said, the solidarity that was expressed with Palestine at every single match, really from beginning to end, in a way that, again, would probably be much more confronting a kind of a clampdown in any other circumstance. But in this case, it seemed to actually, be given that sort of space. And I think the real questions that it poses in the end is sort of, what is the takeaway? What is going to be the long-term, impact of this type of mobilization? Is it just a one-off thing that happens because you've got this major tournament here? Or is it the building of solidarities and networks and identities that are likely to sustain into the future? And so I think there's certainly a lot of hope that that's where this goes.
You've been so generous with your time, Professor. Just a couple more questions. Is there a program, a soccer program, that we should keep our eye on for reasons political or reasons on the pitch that maybe we're not looking at right now in the Middle East?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, everyone's talking about it, so it deserves mention. But I think what the state of Saudi Arabia is doing certainly deserves more scrutiny than it's probably getting. I think, obviously, when you see major players, not just Cristiano Ronaldo, but then this past summer, everyone from Karim Benzema to N'Golo Kanté to Sadio Mane to many, many others who've all decided to leave behind careers. In some cases, these are players who are in their peak, to go to sign for a league that nobody has ever heard of, that nobody watches, and making 10 times the salaries that they were getting before. I mean, it could be a flash in the pan thing. We saw it in China, I think, about a decade ago, where they tried to kind of make this huge splash on the global soccer market, you know, buying all these players, bringing them to China to play, and then it sort of fizzled. The Saudis, of course, are saying that that's not what's happening here, and that this is part of a long-term strategic plan to diversify all of that oil revenue into, these big projects. And of course, when you deal in the realm of culture, there's a lot to be said about kind of what this means in terms of trying to, sports wash potentially the reputation of a Saudi crown prince, who, of course, as we all very well know, has been responsible for so many atrocities in the region and really beyond. And I think that this is really where the focus should be in terms of what this actually means, not just for the sport. And again, I think there is sometimes an unfair singling out. What the Saudis are doing is in many ways a logical continuation of the corporatization of sports. Again, all the things that you've been writing about for so many years, Dave, but thinking about the kind of the role of kind of these private equity firms in terms of what they're doing to sports and making it really out of reach from fans. And in this case, we're seeing it on a kind of a much more industrial scale. And I think that's worth kind of keeping an eye on that, at least going forward.
Absolutely. Last thing, your next project, what should we be looking for?
Well, there's a few things I'm working on, but a lot of it is kind of, tangled with the same kinds of questions of dealing with social movement. So I'm looking at kind of the legacies of different religious activist trends across the Arab world. I will always continue to follow football and see kind of the impact that it's having in society. And so hopefully there'll be other avenues to continue the work that we've done with this book. And thinking about kind of the role of culture more generally. I know you're a big film guy, Dave. I'm thinking a lot about a course that I teach called Empire in Film and thinking about ways to kind of be able to perhaps present that in book form, but that's kind of well into the future.
Absolutely. My goodness. Where do you even get started? I had like five movies flicker through my head as soon as you said that. This has been terrific. Professor Abdullah Al-Aryan, the book is called Football in the Middle East, State, Society, and the Beautiful Game. It's a must read. Thanks so much for joining us on Edge of Sports.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Thank you so much to Shamiqua Holdsclaw. Thank you so much to Abdullah Al-Aryan. Thank you to everybody on the staff here at the Real News Network. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. You're not going to believe next week's show. Just you wait. We are out of here. Peace.
Thank you so much for watching the Real News Network, where we lift up the voices, stories, and struggles that you care about most. And we need your help to keep doing this work. So please, tap your screen now, subscribe, and donate to the Real News Network. Solidarity forever.